Hello, everyone, and welcome to Employment Matters, a legal and HR podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host, Pete Waltz. With the pandemic hopefully moving in a better direction in the U.S., employers are faced with questions and challenges as we return to the new workplace. This session will focus on HR policy considerations for remote working, both in-state and out-of-state, returning to the office and what hybrid offices are going to be all about, vaccines, and promoting a safe work environment. Today's program, Welcome Back America, is moderated by Laura Pasqualoni, a partner at Lewis Rocha LLP in Arizona. As a bonus, we had the chance to survey some of our listening audience in advance to gather their questions, and the panelists will use those in addressing their commentary. Let's join Laura as she introduces the program and moderates the discussion.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for being with us today. My name is Laura Pasqualoni, and I'm a partner with Lewis Rocha Rothgerber Christie. I'm coming to you from Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to our webinar, Welcome Back America. We're looking forward to a great discussion. As the title of our presentation suggests, today we're focusing on what feels like for many a return to our pre-pandemic employment world. With the pandemic showing signs of tailing off in parts of the world, employers like Apple and JPMorgan Chase are preparing to get more staff back to their desks. Companies that ordered their employees to work from home in March of last year are now starting to bring employees back into the office. Our focus today will be on the issues employers are struggling with as they begin to think about whether and when to bring employees back. In many ways, life does seem to be returning back to normal with the prevalence of vaccines and states lifting pandemic-related restrictions. But on the other hand, we have experts saying that we're not at herd immunity yet, and we still have these variants lingering out there. The Delta variant in particular is fueling rising caseloads in the U.S. as vaccination rates slow. And there's also the reality that many workers have become accustomed to remote work. According to a recent Gallup survey, 45% of full-time workers in the U.S. are still working remotely, at least some of the time. And among white-collar workers, the statistic is even higher. It's at about 70%. And survey after survey shows an overwhelming majority of workers say they want flexible work options to continue. So in addition to facing the challenges of lingering COVID-19, employers also face a workforce that may not be ready or willing to come back. So welcome back, America. But what does this workplace look like that we are all returning to? And will it be the same? Our panelists are here to talk about these issues and where employers go from here. So with that said, I'd like to start by introducing our panelists for today's webinar. We have Catherine Campbell, an attorney with Friday Eldridge & Clark, coming to us from Arkansas. We also have Kayla Ernst, an attorney with Ice Miller in Indiana. We have Kara Shea, a practice group leader and attorney with Butler Snow, coming to us from Tennessee. And last but not least, we have Noah Oberlander, an attorney with Reed Smith in Virginia. Now that you know our speakers, I'm going to turn to a quick overview of what we plan to cover today. We're going to start with an update on vaccines. Catherine is going to give us an update on what our country looks like right now in terms of vaccination rates. She'll also talk about the status of employers' ability to mandate vaccines and potential traps related to requiring vaccines or even incentivizing vaccines. We'll next discuss the topic of what we call the wandering workers, or workers who are working remotely from different jurisdictions. Kara will touch on some of the practical pitfalls of long-distance telework, particularly with different jurisdictions at play. We will then turn to remote work issues that employers are facing as they try to bring employees back into the office. Kayla will touch on strategies for addressing remote work requests and potential legal issues when employers or employees refuse or are reluctant to return to work. And finally, we'll end our presentation with a discussion of general health and safety issues that employers are facing as they bring workers back. Noah will give an update on OSHA and CDC guidance and practical considerations for adopting return to work policies. So now that you have an idea of what we're covering today, let's get right to it. Let's start with Catherine, who is here to talk about vaccines. Before we talk about legal and HR issues that come into play, Catherine, I think it would be helpful to begin with a bit of an overview on where we are in the U.S. in terms of getting vaccinated. Could you talk to us about that, Catherine?
Thanks, Laura. And hi, everyone. For the most part of 2020, I think employers were waiting on the vaccine and really saw the vaccine as the light at the end of the tunnel. Now that the vaccine is here and widely available, it's good news, but it has certainly created some questions and issues of its own. So as you all know, we have three vaccines now that are widely available, and these are currently available under FDA's emergency use authorization. As of July 1, 47% of the country was fully vaccinated, and a recent survey I saw shows that the percentage of working Americans who are vaccinated is slightly higher at close to 70%.
So it sounds like a good majority of the workplace is now vaccinated, Catherine, but we're not at herd immunity quite yet, and employers are still facing the reality that a good percentage of their workplace is not going to be vaccinated. In terms of adopting workplace safety protocols, is your guidance different for employees who are vaccinated versus not vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it is. So in late May, the CDC released recommendations for fully vaccinated individuals and confirmed that this guidance would treat individuals differently based on vaccination status. So a person who is fully vaccinated, which would mean 2 weeks after their second dose, they do not need to wear masks or physically distance unless otherwise required by an employer's rule or a local business. They can resume domestic travel without the need to quarantine upon return, and they can refrain from testing following a known exposure to COVID-19 and refrain from quarantine following a known exposure so long as they remain asymptomatic. And a few of these things are particularly important for employers. You know, we're seeing employees who are able to come back to the office without masks if they are vaccinated. We're also seeing employees that no longer need to quarantine for that 10 or 14 day period following a known exposure to the virus, which is a huge plus for employers who are having to juggle unpredictable and often low workforces during parts of 2020 due to that quarantine requirement. Knowing the vaccination status of your workforce is potentially very useful for employers for a couple of reasons. So it can help demonstrate a company's commitment to the health and safety measures and limit potential liability. It can also help companies make informed decisions about reopening. You know, do they want to bring everyone back? Do they want to do that now or maybe sometime in the future when people have had a longer chance to get vaccinated? Do they need to require people to continue to wear masks and provide that PPE? Do they need to have people work in certain settings, you know, with certain spacing? So all kinds of considerations to think about when bringing folks back to the office. And finally, it can help determine if workers must quarantine after being exposed to COVID, which is also important.
Thanks, Catherine. That's really helpful. Do you anticipate any changes in the horizon with respect to vaccines?
You know, I think that we are expecting a couple of changes. We are on the cusp of permanent FDA approval for two of the vaccines, hopefully within the next month or so, according to the CDC. That would be for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. Currently, we're operating under emergency use authorization, as I mentioned earlier, and I've heard the CDC director say recently, you know, that this feels like unknown territory for some individuals, and so they are hopeful that with permanent approval, this might give the confidence boost needed to put some people over the edge to get vaccinated. So that's the good news. The bad news is the Delta variant, which is the highly contagious strain of the virus that is running rampant now in parts of the country, in particular, including my home state of Arkansas. And with the rise of this transmissible Delta variant, it means that unvaccinated people are at particular risk of getting the virus, and it's really increased the urgency to get people vaccinated. The CDC has said that vaccines are effective against the Delta variant, and the statistics are staggering. So 99% of the hospitalizations and 99% of deaths have been in unvaccinated individuals. So, you know, the rise of the Delta variant has really brought back into question these issues that we're talking about vaccines. So the biggest question mark right now is the Delta variant. And as with all things COVID related, there really aren't any clear answers at this point. And it's just a factor that we're going to have to continue to keep an eye on.
So with this Delta variant lingering out there, Catherine, and the research so far that you mentioned that shows that vaccines seem to be pretty effective, even in relation to the Delta variant, I think we can expect more and more employers to wonder whether they should be mandating vaccines. Can you talk about where we are in terms of that all-important question?
Absolutely. And I will say anecdotally, you know, the question of whether employers can mandate vaccines is one I was getting a lot several months ago, and it kind of fell off. And now I'm starting to get it a lot again with the Delta variant on the rise. The answer is yes. The EEOC has made clear that employers may require employees who are physically entering the workplace to be vaccinated. Now, any policy would need to comply with the ADA, Title VII, and other workplace laws, which I'll get into, but the EEOC has said that that is okay. And this principle has been tested and approved by the courts already. A federal court in Texas recently ruled in favor of a Houston hospital that had established a mandatory vaccine policy for all of its employees. The court held that the mandatory vaccination policy was permissible and dismissed the case. And really, the order was pretty short and to the point and just said that the policy was fine and that if the employees disagreed with the policy, they were free to find employment elsewhere. So I think we'll see more cases like that, but the trend is upholding that EEOC guidance. In a recent survey I saw that showed that even though the vaccine can be mandated, most employers at this point, about 80%, are not requiring the vaccine and they're simply encouraging it or incentivizing it. But like we've said, with the Delta variant on the rise, I think the question of mandates will become even more important than ever.
Thanks, Catherine. So it sounds like there is really good guidance out there suggesting that employers can require the vaccine, although you mentioned that a lot of employers are still reluctant to take that step. If employers do decide to do that and require the vaccine for their workforce, what issues should they be thinking about before they do?
Yeah, so if you do require the vaccine, you must provide accommodations under the ADA and Title VII. So under the ADA, you must consider whether an employee has a disability that would prevent them from getting the vaccine. You will need to engage in the normal interactive process and ask questions like, does the employee have a disability? And if so, what kinds of accommodations are available to those employees without providing an undue hardship on the employer? Helpfully, the EEOC has recently provided some examples of reasonable accommodations that it feels would be appropriate for unvaccinated employees. These include wearing face masks, social distancing, modifying your work shift or your work location, periodic testing, telework, and temporary reassignment. Now, under Title VII, you would consider whether an employee has a sincerely held religious belief that would prevent them from getting the vaccine. And when considering Title VII accommodations, employers should keep in mind that Title VII defines religion very broadly. So it includes your traditional organized religions, but it also includes religious beliefs that are new or uncommon or not part of a formal church or sect. So a practice is religious under Title VII if the employee's reason for the practice is religious. I like to think about it as basically if there's a belief about, you know, a higher being or a greater purpose that guides the employee in their daily life, that would be a religion for these purposes. You know, as with any type of accommodation, this is really a case-by-case, fact-specific evaluation. So I would caution against any hard and fast rules. And I think that we'll probably see more accommodation requests in the COVID vaccine realm than we might typically see. And because these are so nuanced, you know, training for supervisors and managers on how to identify and field these requests, I think will be helpful because accommodation requests often do not come packaged in a nice bow and look necessarily like an accommodation request every time. So I think training on this issue will be important. A few other things to keep in mind from a wage and hour perspective, if you're requiring the vaccine, you will need to pay the employee for their time off to get the vaccine and any potential side effects. You know, we've heard that particularly on the second dose, employees might need a few hours or a day off. And so you would want to compensate them for that time. In addition, some worker comp laws may require employers to pay for vaccine-related injuries if the employee is injured or experiences side effects from the vaccine. And the final thing I'll mention is that the EEOC has really emphasized that employers should be aware of the disparate impact on protected classes that a vaccine mandate might have. So what I would say there is as you are rolling out any kind of mandatory policy, just keep in mind the impact that it is having on protected classes and bear that in mind as you roll that policy out.
Thanks, Catherine. That sure does seem like a lot for employers to keep track of if they decide to take that step in mandating the vaccine. And some employers may be reluctant to go as far as requiring the vaccine. As you mentioned, a lot of employers are reluctant, it sounds like. So what other options do those employers have?
Yeah, so we now know that employers may offer incentives to their employees for getting the vaccine, which is good news. There was a bit of a question mark around this issue for the early part of this year. At the end of the Trump administration, the EEOC had proposed some rules about incentives for wellness programs. Those rules were put on hold by the incoming Biden administration. And so there was a period of limbo where people did not know how these incentive rules might impact COVID vaccine incentives. So the good news for everybody is that the EEOC released guidance at the end of May that clarified that employers can provide incentives to employees for getting the vaccine. And they differentiated between incentives provided by employers who are providing the vaccines themselves and employers who are incentivizing employees to go get the vaccine from a third party. So that would be like an employee going and getting it from their own doctor or from their own pharmacist. So for an employer who provides the vaccine either by themselves or through an agent, they are allowed to incentivize an employee, but it must not be so substantial as to be coercive. So it would need to be a de minimis incentive. Those frozen rules that I just referenced give some examples of things that may fall into this category. And those are water bottles or $5 or $10 gift cards. So although that doesn't necessarily relate, those do give a few good examples of what would fall under this category. Now, these limits do not apply if the employer is simply incentivizing and encouraging their employees to go out to their own doctor and get the vaccine. So in theory, an employer may provide any type of incentive so long as that employee is going to their own doctor. But in practice, we would recommend that it still be reasonable and still be tied to the vaccine in some way. So many companies are offering these types of incentives. I'm sure you've seen some of these in the news. Dollar General is giving vaccinated employees 4 hours of PTO. Kroger is giving a $100 bonus. American Airlines is giving folks a day off. Publix is giving their employees a $125 gift card to their stores. One of my favorite examples, one of my clients has all of their employees who get vaccinated by a certain date entering into a company raffle, and whoever wins gets $1,000. So these are all just ideas of ways to encourage people to go out and get the vaccine. One thing I would note, though, is for these cash payments and gifts, those would need to be treated as non-discretionary bonuses from a wage and hour perspective.
Thanks, Catherine. It sounds like offering incentives may be an attractive option for a lot of employers. Is there any advice you can provide us on how employers can make their incentive programs work in practice?
Sure. So if you're going to offer incentives, you obviously need to know if an employee is vaccinated or not. And the EEOC has advised that asking employees if they're vaccinated is not a disability-related inquiry under the ADA. So you can ask employees if they're vaccinated and you can ask them to show proof of vaccination. You shouldn't ask for more information than that. So I would caution against asking questions like why someone hasn't been vaccinated or whether they intend to get vaccinated in the future. You're going to want to keep it short and sweet on your questions there. We also know that the employee's vaccination status is protected information under the ADA. So you're going to want to keep it confidential and separate and apart from their personnel file. I think from a practical perspective, it might be easiest to not even collect that information in physical form and to just get the information from the employee and not have a copy of their vaccination card. And you'll also want to think carefully about who you share that information with because it is protected information.
Catherine, thank you so much for this update and helpful discussion on how employers can evaluate their options with regard to the vaccine. I'm now going to turn to Kara and the topic of remote work. One way to potentially avoid the pitfalls and challenges of deciding whether to require vaccines might be for employers to permit employees who can exclusively work remotely to continue to do so. And we know from the surveys that I mentioned that a lot of workers really enjoy the flexibility that comes with remote work. Many employees may even insist on remote work options going forward. Of course, remote work can also mitigate the challenges of maintaining a safe work environment in light of COVID and the variants lingering out there. So for employers who want to continue to be flexible in offering telework options, or who may even want to convert portions of their workforce to telework on a permanent basis, Kara, can you talk about what the legal considerations are that they should keep in mind?
Sure, I'm happy to. And The whole concept of telework is so much more in the picture than I thought a lot of us thought it would be at this point in the game. I remember a lot of talk about going back to normal and what that would look like. And at one point, we all probably pictured everybody back in the office or the workspace, but that's changed. And there are some important reasons for that. I remember when we first started doing the return to office presentations like this, back when the vaccine was first rolling out. And it was sort of an assumption that, you know, not everybody can get the vaccine yet, but as soon as everybody can get it, most everybody will. And we'll have this really normal public health situation because we'll be at herd immunity. That hasn't happened. Everybody can get the vaccine pretty much now, and we're standing at some pretty low vaccination rates compared to where we thought we would be. Nationally, we're doing better than we are in some locations. I think it depends on where you are. In Tennessee, where I am, we're below 50% vaccination rate. In Nashville, we're a little higher. That's where I am. But in outlying counties, you're seeing vaccination rates as low as 30%. And that's where our workforce is a lot of times. So we're in a situation where we are dealing with an unvaccinated workforce more than we thought we would be, and an unvaccinated applicant pool. And in talking about vaccine mandates, Catherine, I think you're right. A lot of my clients have been more interested in that lately, and the signs are good on the federal level for that. But you've got to look at the reality. If you do a vaccine mandate, are you going to be able to fully staff up? And I think that depends on where you are and what the vaccination rates are looking like. And you got to check your state law. I think Montana is the only place that said employers can't have a vaccine mandate on the state level. But I think something like 36 states are at least looking at that kind of legislation. And here in Tennessee, we have a new law that went into effect in June that says public employers can't require vaccines. So, for all of these reasons, plus what you mentioned, Laura, in terms of people just like telework and they don't want to come back, employers, I think, are rethinking the idea of continuing telework. And before I get into kind of some of the pitfalls, I think a major issue is that when we rushed everybody out of the office last year, it was done in a rather hurried manner. Now, we all wanted everybody to be safe, and we just said, get out, go home, be safe, and we'll think of the rest later. And a lot of sort of laissez-faire situations developed in terms of telework, where it wasn't really structured, people weren't really being monitored or supervised as they usually would, and things got kind of lax. So for employers that want to continue telework for the health and safety reasons, or because employees like it, or because they think it saves them cost, for instance, on overhead, now's really the time to look into those arrangements and get your arms around them and make sure you're monitoring them appropriately. But as you mentioned, there are some legal pitfalls to consider. So moving on, we'll kind of go through what those are. People have been moving around, and we've got to get a handle on where they are. The United States Postal Service statistics show that 15.9 million Americans moved during the pandemic, and that's more than the year before by 3% overall. But in terms of temporary moves, that's more than a 27% increase over the prior year. So we have some people that have moved for good. We've heard of that phenomenon, fleeing the cities, going to more outlying areas. But then we have the people that decided to just do the pandemic somewhere else temporarily, right? We're going to my family's house in Florida, or we're going, somewhere else in the country where we can be in nature and do our jobs at the same time. And what we've been finding out is some employees have failed to tell their employers where they went. You have a telework workforce that you're seeing on Zoom or talking to on the phone, and you don't realize that some of them have moved very far from your location and maybe even across state lines. I read a story about a company in Seattle that had offered a job to an employee during the pandemic, which would have required her to move to Seattle, but she decided to instead stay in Miami, and she worked there for over a year, doing the same job she had been hired to do in Seattle. I had a client that came to me and said, we have these management teams, and one of our managers was allowed to telework as part of the pandemic, as all of the managers in her job group were. But we just found out 2 weeks ago that she's moved from Tennessee to Georgia, 4 hours away. So not only putting a lot of distance between her and the employer's operation, but crossing state lines. She never told anybody she was doing that. I think she ran it by her direct supervisor, and the supervisor didn't pass it along to anybody else. And the client came to me and said, well, do we have to let her stay there? Because we're trying to bring people back into the workspaces and the offices this summer. And she's a manager who has physical locations she needs to visit as part of her job. And previously, those were all within an hour of where she lived. And so we had to really think about that. And they didn't have an agreement in place, and they didn't have a clear understanding of what was going to happen when she moved to another state 4 hours away. I think that's happened to a lot of employers all over the country. So not only does that present a logistics issue, it can present a legal issue. There's this idea that we have sometimes that employees have, that employers have, well, I can do this job from anywhere. And that may be true in terms of the job duties, but the legal issues are there. And I think employers may not realize some of them. If you have workers that are crossing state lines to work in another state, even temporarily, that can trigger employment laws of that other jurisdiction. The state, as well as some cities, have employment laws. And even having just one person in that location can trigger your obligations under those laws. A lot of our clients are already multi-jurisdictional. We represent companies that have employees all over the place, and they're used to dealing with that. But my client in Tennessee didn't think of itself as multi-jurisdictional. It thought of itself as a Tennessee company. And I said, well, if you have employees in other states, you've now become multi-jurisdictional, and you need to figure out what that means.
We're seeing a lot of workers who are coming here from places like California. Many of them seem to be continuing to work remotely for companies that are based out of state. Can you talk about some of the legal ramifications of a remote worker out of state, but continuing to work for the same company?
Sure, absolutely. I'm not a tax lawyer, nor do I play one on TV, but that is probably the number one most immediate ramification an employer needs to think about are the tax obligations that might be triggered if you have employees working in other states. This creates headaches for the employee as well as the employer. The employee may be subject to withholding obligations in that state where they're located. My state, Tennessee, doesn't have a state income tax, for instance, but other surrounding states do. And so you may need to treat that paycheck differently, and the employee may have to file a tax return in that other state where they're located doing the work. And likewise, you as a business, the wages that you pay to employees are going to be subject generally to the tax treatment under the laws where the employee is located. So you need to think about the individual tax implications as well as the withholding issues. I've known of situations where employees have to now file multiple tax returns because some of the obligations for the year were in one state and some were in another where they moved during the pandemic. Now, there are some reciprocity agreements between states. There are some states that enacted relief during the COVID period for temporary relocation, but all of that is state specific. So I can't even tell you what the rule is per se on reciprocity. You have to look at the state where the employee is working and figure out the law of that state and how it interacts with the state where your business is located. Employers also need to be aware of obligations on their business if they are doing business in another state. There are things such as franchise taxes, business taxes, registration fees. If what those teleworkers are doing in that other state triggers those laws. And it really varies again from state to state. For instance, states such as Texas and Washington, and I worked through some of these issues recently with a client. Normally, if you're doing less than a certain dollar amount of business in those states, you're not considered as doing business there and you don't have tax obligations. But under the rules about a business nexus, if you have even one employee that's working and earning wages in that state, that may mean you're doing business in that state, in which case you have to register and pay certain taxes and fees. So again, there's no easy solution. You just got to figure out what laws apply and abide by them. Unemployment. If you have an employee who's working in another state remotely, they probably can file an unemployment claim in that state if you terminate employment, and you will be subject to those unemployment laws, and you may be required to pay into the unemployment system in that state. How many employees you have is going to vary in terms of the trigger from state to state, but you're going to need to look into it. And beyond just unemployment taxes, some states have additional taxes. You mentioned employees in California. Again, I'm not a tax lawyer and I'm not a California lawyer, but they have a lot of laws there that we don't have in Tennessee. And if you're an employee, if you have employees in California, you have to pay in not only to the unemployment tax, but there's an employee training tax you have to pay and a state disability law tax you have to pay. We represented a client in Mississippi that hired somebody in California during the pandemic without knowing any of this, and it was a rude awakening for them. And 9 states now require you to pay into paid family and medical leave insurance programs. So just make sure you know what you're getting into. Are you covered for workers' compensation? If someone injures themselves while working remotely, even if it's in their home office or in their kitchen, while they're on their laptop, that's probably a covered workers' compensation claim. And do you have coverage that will cover that person in that remote location, possibly in another state? You need to check with your carrier and you need to check applicable law. Different states have different wage and hour laws. Are you having that person record time properly? Are you reimbursing them for expenses properly? In Tennessee, we don't have to reimburse expenses. In California, you do. So you've got to make sure that you're doing that correctly. Other states may have break time laws that you don't have in your state, or mandatory sick leave laws that you don't have in your state. If you terminate somebody, do you have to pay out their accrued paid leave? In Tennessee, we don't. But in a lot of states, you do. So you're going to have to modify your policy there if you terminate somebody who's working in another state. One solution a client has suggested to me is, well, let's just make the out-of-state workers 1099 independent contractors. Got to look closely at that. If they are doing the duties of employees, that's not going to work anywhere. But even if it would work in your state, the state where the remote worker is may have a more stringent 1099 requirement. In California, it's very difficult to get an employee under that standard. So you need to keep that in mind. And you can be sued in those other places. If you have a remote workforce in a different state, they can sue you in the state courts in that state, and you'll have to go there to defend the claim. So those are the issues you need to think about. It varies state to state. It's a lot of work to get your arms around it.
Thanks, Kara. You mentioned a lot of the legal challenges that can arise when you have employees working remotely from different jurisdictions. And I imagine some employers might be concerned as well about the practical aspects of having to manage long-distance workers who telework. Could you talk about that briefly?
Yeah. And again, this applies to all telework, even if it's not across state lines. But I think the longer the distance, the more difficult it is. You've got to establish oversight, communication protocols. You have to make sure they're using secure equipment and appropriate confidentiality measures to protect your information. Again, a lot of times enough attention wasn't paid to all that when the primary concern was safety and just getting people out of the workspace. But if you're going to continue the remote work arrangement for whatever reason, you've got to get your arms around all of that. If I want to go inspect somebody's work site to make sure they have appropriate equipment and security protocols, it's easy for me to do that if they're 5 miles away. It's not so easy for me to do that if they're 100 miles away or 3 states over. So you really need to think about how you're going to monitor those situations. A lot of times in a telework agreement, you say, we're going to try telework, and if it doesn't work, we're going to bring you back into the office. Well, that, again, is not going to be so easy to do if they're a long distance away from the office. And so you may need to modify those types of agreements. All the stuff I just mentioned, you've got to make sure that wherever you have teleworkers, you're in compliance with the local laws that apply in those locations. That's a lot to do. And there's benefits to having telework, including all around the country. But you've got to kind of do that balancing analysis of, is it worth all the work that goes into making sure those relationships are working properly on a practical level and are legally compliant.
Thank you so much, Kara. That's incredibly helpful. I'm going to actually move on to Kayla now, Kayla Ernst, who's going to talk about remote work. We're going to talk about a different issue that's specifically related to remote work, and that is potential discrimination and accommodation issues that can arise, whether that be under the Americans with Disabilities Act or other anti-discrimination laws. Even before the pandemic, employers had to grapple with the issue of offering remote work as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. And I think that will continue to be an issue for employers who have to grapple with this as we approach this post-pandemic environment. Kayla, can you tell us how the legal landscape has changed in that area since the pandemic?
Yes, Laura, happy to. So the standard under the ADA regarding reasonable accommodations hasn't changed, but the context has now that we've seen the pandemic, now that we've seen more people teleworking. And what has been helpful, even though the standard hasn't changed, is that during the pandemic, the EEOC has issued a lot of guidance on this topic. And our listeners can find that guidance in the event resources section of the landing page. And that guidance covers some of what I'll cover today and a lot more. So I would really encourage our listeners to take a look at that guidance. And kind of backing up and starting from the beginning and talking about what that standard is. So when you're thinking about the ADA, an employer has a duty to provide reasonable accommodations that enable workers with disabilities to perform their jobs, unless doing so would pose an undue hardship. And since the pandemic, we know that there's a lot of employees teleworking now. So one side of it is how do employers accommodate workers who are working remotely who have disabilities? So there may be someone who at the physical workspace was receiving some type of reasonable accommodation due to a disability. And now that employee is teleworking, well, that employee might need a different type of accommodation than the employee used in the employer's workspace. So if an employee requests an additional or a different type of accommodation now that they're working remotely, then the employer would need to go through the interactive process and see if it may need to provide a reasonable accommodation to meet those needs. And the reverse is also true. So now we're kind of working backwards. Now we have workers who are working remotely, and now we're returning to the workforce. So those employees who are maybe entering the workforce for the first time in the physical workspace or are returning to work may request new or different accommodations. So those are also requests that employers will need to consider. And those conversations can start now, even if employees are teleworking. So the EEOC has told us that employers can inform the workforce that employees with disabilities can request accommodations in advance if they believe they need them when the workplace reopens.
Thanks, Kayla. So let's say an employer did have many of its employees teleworking during the pandemic, but it's reopening the workplace now. Does an employer automatically have to allow its employees to work remotely if they request it as an accommodation?
So not automatically. It's not always the case. As with all reasonable accommodation issues, it's going to be a case-by-case analysis. But the employer just needs to go through that same process so it can engage in the interactive process to gain an understanding about any disability-related limitations that might necessitate an accommodation. So if there's no disability-related limitation that requires teleworking, then the employer doesn't have to provide that accommodation. Or if there is a disability-related limitation, but an employer can effectively address the need with another form of reasonable accommodation at the workplace, then the employer can choose that alternative rather than having the employee work remotely. Just generally speaking, employers have some discretion when it comes to choosing among effective or reasonable accommodations for disabled employees. And another part to think about this too is that employers aren't required to excuse employees from performing essential functions of the job. And so even if employers maybe temporarily excused employees from performing an essential function during the pandemic, the employer doesn't have to necessarily continue to excuse that essential function once it's returning to the workplace. So for some jobs, you can imagine that physical presence is an essential function of the job. Maybe that was excused temporarily due to the pandemic, but it may not be able to be excused now if employers are having their employees return to the workplace. And all that being said, there's one more important caveat, and that's that the EEOC has told us that the fact that an employer provided temporary telework could be relevant if the employee is now asking to work remotely as an accommodation, and that the pandemic kind of served as a trial period in some senses. that could show whether certain employees could perform their essential functions while working remotely.
Thanks, Kayla. It sounds like remote work accommodations under the ADA will be a big issue for employers going forward. Apart from the ADA, though, are there other discrimination concerns that employers should be thinking about as it relates to remote work issues?
Yes. So one issue is how an employer is implementing its remote work policies to make sure that they're implementing it consistently, treating employees consistently. And the EEOC has given us the example that female employees can't be given more favorable treatment than male employees because of a gender-based assumption about who may have caretaking responsibilities for children. Another potential issue is unequal treatment of remote and in-office workers. So the reason that someone is working from home may be due to a disability or it could be tied to another protected class. And for that reason, employers should make sure remote workers are getting the same opportunities for advancement, same access to other benefits of employment that in-office workers are getting.
Thanks, Kayla. Let's move on to a challenging and related topic. Let's say that an employee is not entitled to telework as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA and doesn't otherwise have a justification, a legal justification to telework. I would imagine employers will still see reluctance by some workers to come back into the office. The reality is COVID's still out there, although we have seen a drop in cases, that there's a bit of an uptick lately. And there may be those who are simply hesitant or unwilling to come back. Can you talk about whether there are any protections for employees who refuse to come back into the office based on safety or COVID-related concerns?
Sure. So it's a tough topic. We've seen this in the news where employees are afraid to work. They don't want to work because of COVID and safety concerns. And so through the pandemic, we've, you know, had to think about, like, can employers discipline or terminate employees who refuse to work based on safety concerns? And to your question, whether there's potential protections, there are, but that typically, there typically has to be a reasonable good faith basis for an employee to refuse to work based on safety concerns in order for them to be protected from an adverse action. So at the federal level, there's two main sources of potential protection here, and that's the National Labor Relations Act and the Occupational Safety and Health Act. So starting with the NLRA, under the NLRA Section 8A1 generally prohibits employers from terminating or disciplining employees based on protected Section 7 activity. And that prohibition applies to unionized and non-unionized workplaces. So when you think of NLRA, your mind might go to unionized workplaces, but there are protections for all employees in the Act. And refusing to work based on safety concerns may be considered protected Section 7 activity where employees have a reasonable good faith belief of unsafe working conditions. And that activity, that refusal, is in some way concerted activity. In addition to that prohibition, the NLRA also has Section 502 of the Labor Management Relations Act, which is a specific provision, and it prohibits employers from permanently replacing workers who refuse to work based on abnormally dangerous conditions. And so under Section 502, we've learned from the National Labor Relations Board and courts that there typically has to be a good faith belief that those dangerous conditions exist, and the employees must be able to support that belief with objective evidence. And so kind of the takeaway, what's not helpful is that we don't have a lot of cases or board decisions addressing these type of protections in the pandemic type context. But it is clear that there's probably a variety of factors that would go into the analysis of when an employee has a protection. One relevant factor is whether the dangers identified by employees are inherent in their job duties or were known to them when they started the employment. The particular work environment will also be relevant. So, for example, the percentage of vaccinated workers in the workplace, what safety precautions the employer has taken, is the employer complying with all of the state and national and local requirements and guidelines? So it's a case-by-case analysis, but if it's a workplace with high vaccination rates, if it's a safe workplace, if infection rates are down, there may not be a reasonable good faith basis there. And OSHA has a similar protection under 1977.12. In that regulation, there's a potential right to refuse to work. And similarly, an employee must have to have a good faith basis for that protection. And also under that regulation, an employee must try to go to the employer first or other enforcement channels, if possible, to address a safety concern before they can outright refuse to work.
Thank you, Kayla. This has been incredibly helpful. I'm going to turn now to Noah. We've been talking a lot about remote work issues, Noah, but for many employers, remote work is not a viable option. Even for those businesses offering remote work, many will at least be requiring some of their employees to come back to the office on occasion. So Noah, I'm looking to you to talk about safety considerations for employers that are bringing employees back into the office. What are the current best practices that all employers should consider taking to protect workers? And should an employer differentiate between employees who are vaccinated or not vaccinated?
Thank you, Laura. And just as Kayla had said, you know, these safety concerns are very, very real if you're doing, you know, in-person work. And the general guidance has been a multi-layer approach where you've got your federal guidance on what best practices are, but a lot of the meat and potato requirements have been, you know, driven by state mandates or by local mandates. As we've seen some of those lifted, it's created some confusion for employers on what exactly does a safe work environment look like. And I think the most recent development, Catherine touched on this a little earlier before, was in May when the CDC announced its updated guidance for vaccinated individuals. OSHA's guidance didn't immediately take that into account. They put out a banner on that they were updating their guidance, but they did release updated guidance in June that does differentiate and kind of refocus rather than differentiate on those who are unvaccinated and those who are at a higher risk to exposure in the workplace. So they retooled a lot of the baseline safety requirements with that focus in mind. And I want to touch on a few of those. In particular, they recommend that while an employer can relax some of the safety requirements for in-person work, that those who have not been vaccinated or that those who are at higher risk in a high-risk category continue to social distance, and that those individuals also continue to wear masks, and that employers should provide, you know, masks to those employees so that they can work safely. They also have encouraged employers as part of their overall safe in-person work strategy to encourage employees to get vaccinated and take away obstacles that may be preventing an employee from being vaccinated. So things like providing paid time off to employees to obtain the vaccine, as well as time off, you know, if they're suffering from any adverse side effects. One other thing that they recommend too, and this is a critical part of a return to work strategy, is to develop an education and training practice so that employees who maybe have been working remotely for a period of time can have that training and feel empowered when they come back to the workplace. There are also some other things employers should do that aren't really on the employee side, but more operational things. So making sure that, you know, water that may have been turned off to a work site while you're working remotely has been safely turned back on, that the electrical and whatnot are ready to go. You also want to take a look at your ventilation systems to make sure that they are up to code and up to speed. The filtration is being changed. And you may also consider, OSHA recommends considering adding additional HEPA filtration if possible, or increasing circulation of air so that there's a clean breathing environment. You also want to continue to perform routine cleaning and disinfection. You want to make sure that employees have access to those supplies. And again, this fits into the training component that they have access, but they also are regularly cleaning things. And then lastly, there still is a requirement for reporting COVID-19 infections or deaths, inconsistent with OSHA's reporting requirement, but that typically needs to be a work-related injury or death. One other thing to factor in too, and there's, you know, that's OSHA's general guidance in this multi-layer approach, is that, you know, different states are at different places and localities have different rules. So it's very important that you look at your state and local requirements. Because while there are some jurisdictions where there are no requirements for businesses related to workplace safety practices, there are others that continue to have those requirements and restrictions. But apart from what's required, I think that another big factor when looking at the OSHA guidance is, you know, what not only what is required, but what maybe is going to make an employee and the employee population feel that the environment they're returning to is a safe work environment.
Thanks for that, Noah. That was really helpful. I want to talk about now an industry that has really had its share of challenges during this pandemic, and that's the healthcare industry. Are there specific workplace requirements for those working in the healthcare industry that you want to talk about?
Certainly, there are developments on this front as well. So the Biden administration, when in January, had issued an executive order that asked OSHA to look at the efficacy of an emergency temporary standard of what constitutes a safe workplace. So OSHA looked at that efficacy and ultimately published a rule in June that was specific to the healthcare sector. They also updated their general guidance for workplaces generally, but for the healthcare sector specifically is where that emergency temporary standard, which is a requirement, was promulgated. And that is not just focused at those actually providing healthcare services, but it also applies to those who are providing healthcare support services. And the way OSHA has put out some helpful guidance for employers to know, are their operations covered by this new emergency temporary standard, often referred to as the ETS? There are some exceptions on applicability. So for instance, telehealth is accepted. If you are operating in a non-hospital setting, you may also be outside the scope. Or if there are areas that are well-defined and all employees are vaccinated and you meet other certain requirements, essentially that area is well-defined and will not be seeing COVID patients, it may not apply. So nonetheless, if it is applicable, it not only applies to those who are providing the healthcare services, but also those who are providing the healthcare support services. So in a hospital setting, the ETS may not just be applicable to your frontline workers, but also those who are at the hospital site, you know, performing billing or other types of services that aren't direct patient care. So it's really important to take that first look at, is this ETS applicable to my healthcare setting? If it is, there are a number of requirements that need to be followed by employers. The first and most important is developing a written work safety plan. And this is typically applicable if there are 10 or more employees. And that plan is going to be a robust plan that it not only is just written and exists, but has employee involvement. And so far as the regulations say that employees should be consulted on the development of that plan. You should also be conducting regular patient, employee, and workplace screenings, because the focus here is about access control. Is the workplace going to have individuals who have been exposed or have COVID-19? So that screening plays a critical role. You also need to implement safety and mitigation policies and strategies. These range from a variety of requirements, from physical barriers in the workplace to administrative and work practice controls, like those access controls in the screening, as well as making sure that ventilation requirements are up to speed and meet the required standards. Employers in the healthcare setting also need to be providing appropriate personal protective equipment, and not just providing the equipment, but making sure that employees are trained on how to properly use and maintain such equipment. The requirements also have a paid leave requirement for vaccinations and vaccine side effects. And there's also a paid leave requirement if employees are being removed from the workplace related to compliance to the ETS. Then while the employee is out, there is also a paid leave requirement related to that. There's also a required workplace safety training requirement that must be documented. And then there also must be reporting consistent with OSHA and a log of all employee instances of COVID-19. So in the healthcare space, there is a federal standard that is strictly applied, and employers in that space should take a close look at these requirements.
Thank you, Noah. And in just the last minute or so we have left here before we turn to questions, you've talked a lot about the legal issues that employers are facing. And I think Kara touched on this a bit, but what are the practical considerations that employers should consider as employees are returning to the office?
Yeah, I think the really two biggest, most important considerations are to listen to employee sensitivities and also adapt for what makes sense for your business. So if remote working is something that works for your business, you're not necessarily required to go back to only in-person working. But it really is also about listening to employee sensitivities. Surveying employees in an anonymous way is a great way to not only know basic information when making return to work determinations, such as what percentage of your employee population is vaccinated, but also to know the level of comfort that employees have in returning to work. I know that a lot of clients I've worked with have found this to be very effective. Another practical consideration to moving back to in-person work is to do a soft launch or introduce it on a slow basis. So maybe establish one day a week aware employees are returning to work, so they can have that buy-in that, you know what, this is a safe environment where I can come and work and interact with my coworkers. You also may see a soft launch where maybe employees are only working a few days a week, so that, again, you can have that buy-in that the employer has provided a safe place. The last thing to do as well that I would recommend is training. One thing that can be really effective is train employees before returning back to the workplace on what your protocols are, what your policies are. And that will make not only those employees feel that they can return to a safe environment, but their coworkers have also been trained and know that these are the practices and procedures that they should be following. The last item too is on the accommodation issue. You know, for a lot of employees who've been working remotely, the childcare needs have looked different. So just because a workplace may be open doesn't necessarily mean that a school has returned to full in-person operations or that a childcare facility has done the same. So employers should still be sensitive of those practical implications of requiring in-person work for the average employee.
Noah, thank you so much. You've certainly given us a lot to consider as employers are thinking about, you know, when and how to bring employees back into the office. We want to thank those who are still with us. We are going to stay over for a few more minutes because we did want to get to some of the audience's questions. And I'm going to start with Kara, a question that was posed to you by an audience member. This audience member posed a scenario of a client employees who are temporarily working in another state for a couple months and maintain the residency of the state in which the business is located, and then later comes back 2 months later. Do you see any tax issues or employment law issues that might be in play there in that scenario?
Yeah, and I would say the short answer is possibly yes. If you have someone that went to the beach for a week or two and worked while they were at the beach, that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a situation where someone moved their work location somewhere else for a period of time for purposes of work. And there's no magic get out of jail free card because it was temporary or because they ended up coming back or plan to come back. There's no magic bright line at 2 months or 6 months. It really depends on the law of the state where the person went. I'm not saying in all cases there would be liability, but a situation as the questioner describes, I would get some specific advice and look into it.
Thank you, Kara. I'm going to turn to Catherine now for a question that was posed to you. One of the audience members asked, would an employee who's diagnosed with COVID and recovered still be subject to the same restrictions as a non-vaccinated employee who did not have COVID? And should they be encouraged to get a vaccine?
Yeah, we've gotten several questions along these lines in the Q&A, and I think along the lines of whether you can require a vaccination for somebody who has tested positive for COVID. That seemed to be one of the themes. On that issue, I would encourage folks to treat that as an ADA, a potential ADA accommodation request, and seek some more medical input from their medical provider as to what the best course of action would be before taking any next steps.
Thank you, Catherine. I'm going to turn to Kayla now. I'm going to ask you a question about ADA accommodations. Let's say an employee has a family member who could not get the vaccine due to a disability, and it's a high risk. This person's at high risk for contracting COVID-19. Is an employee entitled to telework as an accommodation under the ADA to avoid exposing a family member?
Good question. And that's something that's come up a lot. And the answer is no. So not under the ADA. So the ADA does prohibit discrimination based on association with an individual with a disability, but that prohibition is limited to disparate treatment or harassment situations. And the ADA does not require that an employer accommodate an employee without a disability based on the disability-related needs of a family member. But just because the ADA doesn't require it, it doesn't mean an employer can't provide it as a matter of policy, as long as they're implementing that consistently. Other things to think about here might be whether there's potential FMLA or state leave entitlement if there's caregiving responsibilities for a serious health condition.
Thank you, Kayla. Another question for Catherine, and it's related to the family member issue. You talked about vaccine incentive programs. What about family members? Can you provide an incentive to an employee for their family member getting vaccinated? What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. The answer is no. The EEOC has made clear that employers may not offer incentives for family members getting vaccinated.
Thank you, Catherine. That's a quick one. Kayla, another one for you. We talked about how there are potential protections for employees who refuse to work based on reasonable safety concerns. What about if employees continue to work but are taking other actions to protest unsafe working conditions, such as posting about the company on social media? What are an employer's options there to address that kind of behavior?
Yeah, that's tricky too. An employer can find itself in trouble there. So when we talked about the NLRA protections before, we talked about Section 7 right to engage in protected concerted activity and protesting unsafe working conditions if it's concerted activity is protected. So taking action against an employee for engaging in that type of conduct could be construed as interfering with the protected activities and get the employer in trouble and unfair labor practice filed against them. And it's a topic for a whole other day, but there are circumstances where that type of speech can lose protection under the act. Those circumstances are pretty limited, but generally that's going to be protected speech for the employees.
Thank you, Kayla. Kara, final question for you. Audience member posed whether you can take into account an employee's job performance in offering telework.
I think generally, yes, you can. And I think you should, particularly if you're going to be offering telework indefinitely or permanently. If it's more of a health-related, temporary, pandemic-based accommodation issue, I think you need to use more care in looking at the performance aspect. But if you're incorporating telework into your long-term game plan, you absolutely should incorporate the concept of whether this employee has a good track record, is an appropriate person for telework, and has performed well while doing telework.
Thanks, Kara. And a question for Noah now from an audience member. Do we need to screen employees and clients, consumers, patients that come in with regard to healthcare workers? So for example, you know, temperature checks, self-reports, answer daily, weekly, monthly. What are your thoughts on that topic?
Sure. If covered by the OSHA Healthcare ETS, there are for employees a daily screening requirement before the, or not daily, but a screening requirement before the beginning of each shift. And then for patients, there is also a screening requirement that they would need to be screened before coming into the healthcare space.
Thanks, Noah. A question for Catherine. Are we able to disclose vaccination status to a manager as it pertains to enforcement of a masking policy? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and we've gotten several iterations of this question in the Q&A box. And I think the answer is yes, it is protected confidential information under the ADA. So you're going to want to treat it as confidentially as possible. That said, supervisors and managers who need to enforce a mask policy are going to need to know. And so as long as you limit it to those who are on a need to know basis and you don't disclose it to the entire workforce, that should be fine and help keep in line with some of the other requirements that Noah has said.
All right. Thank you all so much. I think that's all the time that we have for today. It's been a lively program with great insights from our panelists and of experts. We appreciate so much your participation and your questions. We hope you found this to be helpful. And with that, let me turn it back to the host to close out our program. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura, and also to our panel for sharing their thoughts and advice on today's topic. If you'd like to connect with any of our lawyers on the program, click on their bio in the description of this podcast. Also, be sure to check out the ELA website at ela.law. On the website, you can sign up to receive invitations for upcoming webinars, download white papers, get access to on-demand content from our online library, or use the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Pete Waltz. Thanks for listening.